Okay. So, anybody have anything that they really are eager and anxious to talk about? In other words, I'm not asking you to just try to think of something. Does anybody have something on your mind that you would really like us to talk about? So, the show's up to me. Okay. Which doesn't usually work very well. Oh, okay, here we go.
This is just a little something. So get us started.
Right.
Yesterday or last night, I was thinking about this, and this used to come up for me a lot in long-term retreat about the function of dreaming, not dreaming in your sleep. Although that would be a whole other fun thing, place to go. But just the dream, like the ideas, the dreams that come to us, the creativity, the when I'm still and quiet and in a retreat like setting is when that all starts to bubble up and come up, and then it's like, wow, you know, how, where is that, like, what do you do with it that's not indulging it? And then, and at the same time, like how useful it could be, you know. So I kind of came up with this idea that it's wonderful up until the point where you start like attaching to it and fabricating or getting into conflict about what if it didn't happen or something like that, or whatever, you know, like however the mind can go. But I was just wanting to hear what you had to say about the, about that process of having something, a wonderful creative idea come up. Maybe it's in seated meditation, or maybe it's just in a retreat like setting. And because without those, you know, like where, how would we ever have, you know, how would things come into being? Or maybe that's not how it works. So
okay,
maybe things would have come into being if you never had the thought.
So you started out talking about dreaming, and then you started talking about the things that come up in the quiet of meditation.
Well, I meant daydreaming, like ideas about dreams, about what the future or... And then how sometimes they do come up in meditation. And for me, they tend to come up more when I'm in a quiet place. And I've had a dilemma about how much to run with those and when to set them aside.
Yeah. Well.
Is that better?
I think so. But you tell me. Okay, there is a very, there is a lot of similarity between what happens when you dream and what happens when you are, when you have a particularly calm mind in meditation. And related to that are the kinds of things that come up when you're just, you know, relaxed and daydreaming, so to speak. Now, what all three have in common is that the parts of your mind that are busy doing everything, taking care of everything, running your life, planning your future, trying to learn from your past, and so on and so forth, all those parts of your mind are relatively quiescent in all three of these states, right? So when you're dreaming, you enter into a state where what enters consciousness is coming from parts of the mind that don't usually have a chance to project anything into consciousness. When you're in a state of deep meditation, it's the same thing. you know, once all the usual chatter, the garbage, the rehashing of everything, once that goes away and your mind becomes calm and clear, which happens repeatedly at many, to many degrees in many stages, it happens in stage 4, it happens in stage 7, it happens really, really powerfully in the 4th jhana. Yes? What? Oh, flies? Oh, they're your friends. I've told you the story about the flies. Anyway, there are different degrees of this mental calm, and they're extremely valuable because of what they allow to come to the surface that otherwise just couldn't. Yeah, I mean, picture consciousness as a bulletin board, right? And you got this huge crowd of people normally there with all their important business that they want to, you know, use the bulletin board, and so. The ones that we hear from in dreams and in deep meditation are the ones that get a chance at the bulletin board when all those others are offline for a while. Daydreaming is sort of halfway in between. It is usually the roots of our daydreams are wants and fears and desires and hopes and all this other stuff. So it's part of the usual crowd. But because we're in a relaxed state, the usual crowd isn't so thick, but it's still having an influence. But amazing things can come up in the process of daydreaming. Now, in all three of these states, you can come across what I call discursive brilliance. You can come across an experience of understanding something, something clicks, something makes sense, something that is important to you. And you can also have the kinds of things that, well, before I go on to that, some of this can actually, especially in deep meditation, can take the form of powerful insight experiences that allow you to see. It's much more than just figuring out the solution to a problem. It is seeing the solution to the ultimate problem. That doesn't happen. I think if that happens in dreams, it happens much more rarely, but it does happen, and people have described having insight-type realizations in dreams. But I don't know if you're familiar with the history of science, but several major breakthroughs in science were the result of, a scientist who'd been working on something for months or years, and then he falls asleep, and in a dream, all of a sudden, usually in some sort of analogical and metaphorical form, the solution to the problem appears. But even in daydreams, sometimes something can get through. But this is the circumstance that we're talking about. We're talking about access to consciousness by parts of the mind that don't normally have it. And the more well-developed you are in your meditation practice, then the richer, deeper, more valuable, more important are the things that potentially come to the surface. Now, there's one other thing to add to this. Okay. In dreams, our minds are not separate. So in dreams, the content of your dreams, although most dreams, the content of your dreams, is just the stuff that's stored in your own personal mind. But in dreams, stuff can leak through from other minds, many other minds, and you can have the most incredible experiences. And sometimes there's a mixture. For example, something may enter your dream from the experience of some other being at some other time and place. And like anything that happens in your daily life, it may trigger or interact with some part of your conditioning. You know, and so your dream's going to take on that quality of you and this particular part of your conditioning interacting with the memories and experiences that have leaked in from some other mind. In meditation, that is in daydreams, that's I doubt if it ever happens, but you know, I leave the possibility that I'm wrong. But based on my experience and understanding of the nature of daydreams and the fact that I have never ever heard of that kind of thing happening in daydreams. Daydreams isn't a place that can happen, that you get this leak through from other consciousness. Although I suppose you might call it something like that when you find yourself thinking of somebody in the daydream state and then the telephone rings and it's them calling you. That might be an example of it, but pretty minor. Now, in meditation, you're working with your mind, training your mind, and so the filters are up pretty strongly until you get to the very advanced stages of meditation, at which time people, and fourth jhana in particular, at which time people can experience, you know, seeing through the eyes of others, hearing through the eyes of others, knowing the minds of others, and having other life recollections. Fourth jhana and the deep jhanas in particular creates a huge window into what I think Jung accurately described as the collective unconscious. And it's what Shinzen Jung, can't remember his words exactly, but I believe he calls it the realm of power and mystery. Because you're really going way beyond the limitations of your own mind. And depending on where you are, there's no limit to where that can reach. But something of the same thing happens in dreams. So does that answer your question?
Mostly. I'm trying to think though. Yes, that was very, very helpful, insightful. The thing that when I was in deep retreat, I remember trying to keep up a certain meditation schedule and having these ideas come up and thinking, wow, maybe I need to just set aside an hour every day where I just sit and just let whatever comes up wants to come up and just let, maybe that would work itself out. But I didn't ever really exactly do that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it wouldn't have just fed it more anyway.
Well, it could go either way. I mean, that is the essence of the practice that in Zen called Shikan Taza.
Okay.
And it's a powerful practice, but it usually takes years to bear fruit. But depending on, you know, if you're in deep retreat and everything else, you could mix some Shikan Taza in there and have some very profound experiences as a result of it. You know, everything is situationally dependent. I mean, it's part of everything being interconnected. So it means that you ask a question about any practice, any action, any event, you know, and to really understand or answer or work with that, you know, you have to take into account its context and what it's interconnected with. So I wouldn't recommend it too strongly in your daily practice, because if you have that time to set it aside. If you have the time to set aside and you want to do something of a very useful but not mind training nature, do analytical meditation in that time. And I don't mean what you have been taught before, but I mean choose something that's important for you to understand, or a problem, or how to deal with a situation in your life, and then systematically, and I describe that in one of the appendixes in the book. What this does is it allows you to draw much more fully on the resources of your unconscious mind, which is what you're trying to do in all the situations I describe. So I think that would be more productive than doing shikantaza in a daily practice. Now, in a retreat situation, especially in a long retreat situation, it's well worth trying. But even in a two-week retreat situation, it might be worth a try. And if it seems very much like ordinary, what ordinarily happens when you sit down to daydream for a little while, drop it. Mm-hmm. Don't waste your time with it. Your time's too precious in retreat to waste on it. Just as it's too precious in your daily practice to waste on it.
Yes, thank you. That's...
I'm unfamiliar with the term shikantaza. What is this?
It's a Japanese meditation practice where you just sit. The instructions are just sit, don't move, don't fall asleep. Usually sit facing a wall, staring, fairly close to the wall, close enough so the blank wall is all that you see. So you sit there with your eyes open, and it's part of a very structured practice. And somebody walks around with a stick, and if you look like you're dozing off, they give you a whack. But you're just sitting there, being there with what happens in your mind when you're sitting completely still, staring at a wall. And it's a very powerful practice. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from it at all. But I much prefer structured practices that tell you where you're going and how to get there and why.
I too have been running into this problem of the mind seems to have more energy in deeper retreat, that definitely begins to build up. A lot of it tries to push itself into creative ventures. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming very distracting. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily have a very structured, mindfully training way to handle that. The analytical meditation does not seem to be letting that energy get out in the correct fashion. And it takes the form of everything from answers to daily problems to very creative, totally fantastic, sort of dreamlike storytelling imagery. And things in between those two states that might be more practical, but the mind feels like it has all this energy and it's got no strong, structured, very specific, dedicated to the mental training way to use it.
As your mind becomes more unified, much more energy becomes available, and it doesn't have a place to go or places to go. What's the state of energy in your body and physical movements? Has that subsided?
Sometimes yes, that's yeah, okay. Subsides, and then other times it'll come back.
That's what I thought. So you're in a place where sometimes the sensation of the energy currents in your body becomes much more comfortable, even pleasant, no longer disturbing, and you stop rocking and moving and jerking, or whatever you do. I haven't watched you closely enough to know what you do. But not all the time yet. Okay, so your work, PT is rising, PT is manifesting physically, but now you're starting to experience more of the mental aspect of PT, which is a different kind of agitation, but it's the same thing. It's too much energy with no place to go. The two, I think, once you've got the channels open in your body, so that, this is all of the mind's own metaphors, right? That you have a body and that there's energy channels with energy moving through them. But for some reason, all our minds seem to share the same metaphor when we meditate. So, anyway, when, metaphorically speaking, all the channels in your body are open and the energy is flowing smoothly. And in your, when you're in that state of complete pacification, okay, at that point, the energy and the agitation in your mind will be very strong, and your hardest work is to ignore that. Just let it be, just the same way it was in your body. But you're sort of in an in-between state where you still have it sometimes in your body, and you still have it, and you're starting to get it as a mental phenomenon. And what your description says to me, I mean, what it suggests to me, I should say, what it suggests to me is you still have some purification to work through. And that energy that doesn't have anywhere else to go is being directed towards those things that need purification. Like, for example, if you know you don't have any dullness and you're completely bright and alert and present, and you're having a kind of visionary experience of something you know isn't a memory from your life. Okay, that is a symbolic representation of something that you need to deal with that needs purification. So, just as you do, as you did with any purification before that, you allow it to be there until it's too strong to just stay on your breath, and then you drop the breath entirely and you focus your full attention on it from the place of the totally objective observer, asking the question, what are you trying to tell me? What are you trying to show me? What are you trying to teach me? And let whatever comes, comes. If you were at stage 4 and some of it is just brilliant ideas, I would say set it aside for another time. And that may in fact be the best thing to do. But since my sense from what you say is that there is a strong pressure of something that needs to come up into consciousness, get integrated with everything else to complete the unification process of the mind. And then that will open up the channels in your body. And that will make the mental energy much more intense, but it'll just be a state of intense joy and excitement, and it may be really hard to sit still, but it won't be bringing stuff up anymore because it's already succeeded in bringing the stuff up. Okay? Now, so in this case, if a brilliant idea comes up, consider it briefly. Focus, you know, if especially if it's, you've left it there and you said, okay, I can think about brilliant ideas later, and it won't go away and it stays there, then go ahead and focus your attention on it. Kind of with the attitude that, okay, so you're masquerading as a brilliant idea, but who are you really, and what are you, you know, where do we need to go with this? A typical example. It's a brilliant idea about what to do about a particular situation. What's really about it, what it's really about, is how you, through your conditioning, are reacting to that situation, created that situation, or in particular, still somehow feel like you need to do something about that situation. That's what's underneath the level of, oh, I've got a problem and I should do this to solve it. I mean, you've had that a lot of times in daily life, I'm sure, right? You know, you leave a situation, you feel like, okay, this is what I'm going to do about it. I'm going to blah, 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 blah. And after a while, you get to the point where you realize that I don't need to do any of that stuff. All I need to do is deal with my own reaction to it, right? Very similar. So it sounds, that's what it sounds like to me. Does it sound like that to you?
Yes. It's a bit closer than I intended. I have been going through more purification, and it does seem as if the mind might be, it's something that seems like stage 4, but the body seems like it's much more settled, you know, very, very relaxed, pleasant usually, but more purification's been coming up all throughout the week, and that's been the case.
Yes, it feels like stage four. The reason it feels like stage four is whether it happens at stage seven, which is really common, or any of the higher stages. Essentially, what you do is you pop back to the description that we give stage four, because these things that are coming up, they become gross distractions, and then you finesse the situation by focusing your attention on them. And so, yeah, what you're doing, essentially all, when you go into purification mode, you're popping back to stage four. So, and that's fine, there's nothing wrong with it. And then when it comes to whatever resolution it comes to, or when it passes away to be dealt with on another day, then you go back to where you were.
I guess there's two other things. One of them just came up. The body seems, the mind seems to be wanting to use a lot of subtle dullness to sometimes not go through that purification.
Yeah.
It seems to have the effect of slowing things down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something to just leave alone and let that? Like I'm trying to figure out a pacing.
The rule throughout is you practice according to what's happening in the moment. So you're having dullness, you deal with not. But yeah, dullness is one of the mind strategies for not confronting things. And the fact that that's coming up is just another indication that this is something really important, and that's why it didn't come up a long time ago.
And then going back to dreaming, from your descriptions, I sort of expected lucid dreams and these kinds of states, and I have been noticing a certain type of mindfulness.
Yeah.
In dreams.
Yeah.
I know that I'm dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And a situation will come up, whatever it is, talking to my brother on the phone or something odd like that, and they'll be like, okay, I know I'm dreaming, and then there'll be discursive thought, and then it's been actually interrupting my sleep, and it's been waking me up. I'll get up and I'll go, oh, okay, this is a dream, and I got to let these sort of things go. And it has been interrupting my sleep a little bit. Do you have any strategies for making sure that I know these things are dreams, and I know I'm trying to be mindful of them, but the mind gets so energized that it keeps waking up, and that's not.
Okay,
best.
So some of that's a side effect of the PT arising. You've got a lot of energy in your mind even when you're dreaming, and so that's why it's waking you up. And except for if it wakes you up and you're wide awake and having trouble going back to sleep, put all of your attention in your body. Just be totally aware of your body, contact of your body with the bed, the sheets, the everything, and that usually helps. I don't have a lot of other good solutions for that particular problem, but you need to go to sleep with the intention to be mindful in your dreams. So when somebody's been meditating as long as you have, it's very, very common to start having lucid dreams, and it's very important to start practicing mindfulness, because you find yourself doing things in your dreams that you don't want to be doing. And it's something, one of the things that happens to me, and I don't know why I can do this, a couple of other people have said they've had the same experience occasionally. It happens to me all the time. I'll do something in a dream, and I'll say, that's not me. I don't want to do that. That's not the kind of person I want to be. And I'll actually rewind and play it through a different version. You do that too? That's a great way to practice mindfulness. And I don't need to wake up. Did you pass it back to Jessica?
So I think there's a question in here.
Mm-hmm.
The creative things that people are bringing up,
Yeah.
The questioning about that. So when something like that does happen, but it comes out in a, I guess, a sudden manifestation after, I don't know, we'll say some experiences happened, and then some type of creativity does come out and actually kind of out of nowhere, basically.
Mm-hmm. You know where it comes from.
Say that again?
You know where it comes from.
Out of nowhere.
It comes from some combination of your unconscious and the collective unconscious.
Okay. So, in having that experience happen and kind of running with it, letting it do whatever it wants to do, but then eventually there becomes some type of grasping and clinging to it.
Some which?
Grasping and clinging.
Grasping and clinging,
to
yes.
That activity, but it feels like it also feels like it needs its legs to go, to run with, whatever. But I guess where I struggle with it is there does become, my obsessive nature also takes over with it, and then that becomes something that I feel like is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the need to let it be, but there's also the noticing of the grasping to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do ask myself, well, you know, if this wasn't there, or if you let go of it, what does that mean? Would you be okay with that? This type of thing.
Do you ask yourself, if you let go of the object that has arisen, or whether you let go of the grasping?
The grasping.
Okay, good, because that's the question you want to ask. How would I be with this if I didn't have this grasping?
Yes. I'm trying to figure out what exactly my question is also. How to let that be, but not be so. And then I ask myself too, what is it about this activity that you want to have there? I feel like I want this activity. I want to have an activity,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise, I don't know what I would be doing. Maybe reading more or something. But, and at this time, it feels like a good activity to have.
Okay. Well, the approach is, don't try to let go of grasping by let going of the object of grasping.
Okay.
Try to let go of the grasping itself. And say, if I didn't have the grasping, what would my relationship to this object be? And you don't answer the question. And there may be no answer to the question, or there may be a clear answer to the question, and it may not be what you expect. But what you want to do is take this as an opportunity what you have arising in your mind is an object of desire. And what you want to know is, what would my relationship to this object of desire be if I was free from the compulsive, from the compulsive quantity of wanting to, quality of wanting to grasp to it.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Okay, yes.
Okay? And that's where you start to discover some very interesting and wonderful things. And I'm going to use that, if you're satisfied with that, I'm going to use that as a segue into something that I want to talk about. And that is that it has two parts to it that are closely related. One is a clear understanding of the nature of our goal and spiritual awakening. And the other is our place in the world and what role we should play. And I'll tell you, first I'll give you the sources of my thoughts on this. One is when I attended the Western Dharma Teachers Conference in New York. That's where I went in June. One of the presenters there, one of the topics, we spent a large amount of time on one particular topic. And that topic was the Buddhist response to climate change. One of the speakers there was a really amazing person named Rinaldo Brutoco, who is the, I don't know if what his title is, president or whatever, of the World Business Academy.
Foundation.
What?
Foundation.
Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. You know, I mean, you're almost never wrong, but in this particular case, I looked it up recently.
Would anyone mind if we turned the cooler down one notch?
Let's try it. We'll see how it works. We can try it, and if I get too wet and sweaty, I may ask to have it turned up again.
Okay.
I have a very good cooling system. I sweat freely, but when the humidity is high, it my cooling system doesn't work. What's that? Let's see. Okay. Anyway, he explained to us what the Academy is about. The Academy is about studying the changes that are taking place in the world due to a whole variety of different causes. But the most critical one of all is world climate change. And he explained that business responds much more rapidly than governments or science, either one, to this. So the purpose of the Academy is to take all of the research that scientists have done, and instead of presenting it in real cautious, you know, hesitant, not until everything on the planet dies for sure can we say, And business is doing this not out of altruistic motives. The best you could call it would be enlightened self-interest. He said, for example, nobody's making money in Syria today, except maybe warlords and weapons dealers, you know. And so the world business community takes these things that are happening much, much more seriously than the rest of human population, because it affects their bottom lines and the amount of money that they have in their account. He described a meeting he was at in which half of the total wealth of the world was represented in one room. These people are hiring experts, and they want to know what's happening, why it's happening, how much we can do about it. But especially they want to know, what are the changes, and how can we adapt to the changes, how can we keep from losing money because of the changes, how can we make money because of the changes. So that's their motivation. But they're an incredible source of information because they have this motivation. And their prediction is, for one thing, they see much more happening than you're going to hear about. Hate to borrow her phrase because I think she's disgusting, but the lamestream media are not going to tell you what's really happening in terms of global warming. One of the things that is happening is enormous amounts of methane are being released from the Arctic Ocean and as the permafrost melts. And methane is, what, five times more potent than CO2 in global warming, there's parts of the ocean, of the Arctic Ocean, that look like they're boiling because of the amount of methane that's coming up 24 hours a day, week after week. And that and the Academy's best estimate is that civilization as we know it is not going to exist in 30 to 50 years. And the other point he made is that the date at which they think that is going to happen keeps moving closer. So this year, on the basis of the knowledge, it's 30 to 50 years. But 1 year from now, it could be 20 to 40 years, you know? If the other thing that, the other point he made was that although efforts at mitigation absolutely must continue full speed ahead, the time is past to even pretend that mitigation, you know, the disaster is upon us. And I'm going to talk a bit about how that's already happening, too. The disaster is upon us. There is no avoiding it, even if we all got really smart tomorrow. So we need to shift from our thinking and make adaptation a priority. We need to recognize what's going to happen and decide how it is that we're going to deal with it. And the next thing, that was very powerful and moved me. And what I, oh, the other thing that he said, too, is the Academy believes that at this particular point in time, where things are, we have the resources and the technology to do something effective. It's not like we're going to prevent global warming, but there we have the ability to make a powerful difference. That is disappearing rapidly. He said what we lack is the collective will. We've had the technology, we've had the resources for a long time. What we haven't had and what we don't have is the collective will. And I had the immediate thought, which I shared with a number of people in discussion groups at the conference. I said, isn't that our role as Dharma teachers, is to try to reach enough people and change their way of thinking enough that the collective will does develop. And instead of all our isolated traditions where we do these practices and we teach Dharma in this way, and by the way, ours is better than everybody else's, although we tolerate the rest of you because you. What I said, what we need to do this, I said, it's like we've had all these different laboratories in cultural and geographic isolation working on different ways of presenting the Dharma and practices for realizing the Dharma. What we need to do is break down those barriers, take all this collective information that we've all kept hidden away from each other or refused to look at from each other. It hasn't been hidden away, it's only hidden in the way that, the sense that, no, I do Zen, so I'm really not too interested in, it's nice, but you know, I don't have time for it, I do Zen. That's the problem. And my suggestion is if we could break down the barriers and if we could all share what we know, we might come up with something that's powerful enough to reach that number of people. And not only to reach them, but to change them quickly enough that we have the collective will to make use of the resources and the technology that we have to simultaneously work on mitigation and adaptation. Start thinking about what we're going to do when the sea level is 6 to 8 feet higher than it is now. And as you probably realize, most of the big cities in the world are on the coast. That large parts of the biggest cities in the world are underwater. And even if they're only under a few feet of water, they don't function anymore. Venice excluded. They're the only ones that managed to handle it. So anyway, I was struck by what Brutoco said, and I had what appeared to me to be something that could be done by the Dharma teachers at that conference. And as a result, there's two different groups working on that. Yes, and now you wanted to ask something, so you got to get the microphone, huh? And you got to let me. You wanted to ask about my microphone? Wow, I'm going to hold it, because for some reason there's just, it's I don't know why, it just doesn't seem to. I think it's my mouth here, and when it's below and behind my chin. Yeah, right. It hurts. Mustache. Mustache is too short. Okay. I need a headset. I need a headset that's on the same wavelength, or else I need a new transmitter. Well, I hope enough of what I said came across. All right. So then I was thinking about all this. And of course, I was instrumental in getting these two groups started. But between retreats and resting and getting the book to press and everything like that, I'm the only member of those two groups who hasn't participated in the discussions to this point. So I'm a bit disappointed about that. But I'm also proud of myself for not pushing myself to do more than I could do. So the other thing I've been doing is reading this book. It's called A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. And one of the authors is David Loy, who was the other speaker together with Brutoco, who we're talking about, who were the main leaders of this a day-long or day-and-a-half-long discussion of the Buddhist approach to the climate emergency. So I've been reading this, and I find it fascinating. One of the things, I'm reading what these leaders have to say, and I read what all these different lamas and Rinpoches and so on and so forth had to say about it. And they put the blame, they say Buddhists should be the ones lead in the forefront of being active in the world to make these changes, but Buddhists are not. And different one, they didn't talk to each other. They were all interviewed separately. But the same message kept coming through. Buddhists think that the Buddhism is all about transcending samsara. They look at the world, they look at climate change, they say, samsara is like that. It's always been like that. You know, we're in the Kali Yuga. What do you expect? You know, I have more important fish to fry than worrying about this samsaric world. And they condemn that attitude over and over again. The other attitude is, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm a nun, or I'm a monk, and I'm already living simply, you know, and so there's not much I can do. It's huge. This is a gigantic problem. It's going to take different kinds of people and different kinds of solutions. So, in other words, Buddhists have a lot of excuses, and a lot of the excuses come from the teachings themselves. Many, many Buddhists, now I'm not talking about the most educated Buddhists in the Theravadan or the Mahayana or the Vajrayana traditions. I'm talking about the majority of the monks and nuns who aren't that well educated and don't have that deep understanding. They still think of this being about escape from samsara. In the Mahayana, they will happily quote to you that samsara and nirvana are the same thing, rah, 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 rah. And then they behave, and they think as though nirvana is the way out of samsara, which is in total contradiction. That's what I want to talk about. What is this path about? What is awakening about? I mean, the logic and the practice that existed prior to the Buddha was that the way out came after you died. and the way out meant that you didn't get reborn. And there was lots of different theories about, so if you don't get reborn, where are you? What do you do? And of course, we know from the Buddha's perspective, that's a nonsense question, because the I that we're wondering what happens to never existed to begin with, right? So before the Buddha, though, the idea was always, you know, we're going to find an escape. And once we die, then we don't come back again. We've escaped the wheel of samsara. One of the most revolutionary things the Buddha taught is be concerned with this lifetime. Awaken in this lifetime. The goal is awakening in this lifetime. It was only later Buddhists that invented the idea that you might awaken in a future lifetime. And that's based on the misconception of there being a self. Awakening will definitely happen in the future. As far as I can tell, this is how the universe is evolving. And I know Tan Jeff would draw upon all his really rather nasty criticism of the romantics to say, oh, Chuladasa is just another one of those romantic thinking the world. I know better than that. But I do believe that the world is evolving towards full awakening. I do believe that that's what the Bodhisattva vow is a recognition of. I do believe that the idea of bodhicitta is the realization that no one of us can ever become fully awakened until all sentient beings, till the entire universe has become awakened. And that is a reality. What is our relationship to samsara once we become fully awakened? What was the Buddha's relationship to samsara? Did he say, I'm fully awakened now? I think I'll just go walk around and, you know, enjoy myself until I die. Or, well, come to think of it, you know, life's so full of pain, even if I don't suffer, why don't I just quit the whole thing right now? I'll just sit down and, I mean, I'm totally sure he was capable of doing that. He could have sat down and just died. Why didn't he? And what are we supposed to do when we become fully awakened? Well, let's approach it from another perspective. What does it mean to be fully awakened? It means to have wisdom and compassion. And that's what I want to talk about, is the compassion part. You don't really have full and complete wisdom until you become an arhat, or let's say fourth path, because Mahayana has redefined arhat, and so it's not a good word to use anymore because of that. So many people are exposed to the Mahayana critique of the word arhat. But let's say fourth path. Let's say when you've reached the level of realization of the Buddha, what's your relationship to the world you live in, and where do samsara and nirvana fit into that? And what should you do? What did the Buddha do? My answer is that what you should do, and what the Buddha did, was to embrace the world totally, to realize that nirvana and samsara are exactly the same thing. And to embrace the world totally, without attachment and without delusion, is nirvana. And as Garchen Rinpoche put it, which is beautifully well stated, the body and speech of the Buddha were in the marketplace, while the mind of the Buddha dwelt in nirvana, free from craving, free from being entrapped by mental formations, understanding fully not only the emptiness of mental constructs, but but at the same time, understanding the suffering that existed in the world because people didn't know this, and because people didn't have the wisdom. And that, then we come to that, I want to focus on the compassion part. A Buddha has wisdom and compassion. The Buddha totally cares. The two come together. You cannot have true wisdom without total compassion. You can have partial wisdom with no compassion, or a little bit of compassion, or, you know, whatever amount you choose. But it requires complete wisdom to have total compassion. And in the four-path model, on all of the four paths, well, all on the three paths preceding the fourth path, as your wisdom increases, your compassion should increase with it. You are not separate. We are not separate. And the only way you can reach total awakening is everybody else does. So, of course, that justifies trying to help other people become awakened. But does it stop there? And that's the way I thought at one point, many years ago. Nancy asked me what you're trying to do. And that was my answer. I said, well, the only thing I can do is, you know, try to help some other people to awaken. And now I know that that's not true. That's pretty low grade understanding of compassion. It is the noblest thing to do, but to think that that's all you do is, I mean, not too much real compassion in that, not too much real wisdom in that. When you truly understand the interconnectedness and the interpenetration, when you understand the holographic nature of this samsara that we perceive, its underlying holographic nature, when you realize that I was you in another life, and you were me in another life, and I was you in another life, and you, and you, and the cats, and the chickens, and everything, you know, when you realize that, when your understanding of dependent arising, not just causal interdependence, but the interpenetrating nature of reality, then you experience true compassion. But you have to work on compassion. And this is something I've discovered, and this is something that other people are discovering as I guide people and they achieve first path and second path. They find that the compassion, that it's something that they have to work on as well. We have to work on compassion. We have to take the combination of deep insight we have and intellectual understanding we have, and we have to exercise our capacity for compassion. Compassion meditations are important. I'm beginning to realize how important. I feel like I'm, you know, my teacher, Kema Ananda, taught in one way pretty much unvaryingly for many, many years. And then he made the switch and he started teaching about virtue. And for the last years of his life, you know, that was the main thing that he taught about, was virtue. And I feel like maybe I'm at the point of feeling like what at least I want to spend some time talking about in the future is compassion and developing compassion. Because you're a stream enterer, you will have more compassion. And during the afterglow period, you may have hugely more compassion. But as you settle down to kind of a plateau, for some this happens, not for all. Some there's no plateau. They just, you know, they drop off the first stage booster and then they fire the second set of rockets, you know. And but much more common is you know, you have stream entry, there's this great glow, it tapers off, and then you're kind of at a plateau until you realize how unsatisfactory that plateau is, and then you find yourself, in a way, you find yourself, you know, like, wow, this isn't as good as I thought it was, you know. It's almost as bad as it was before a stream entry. I got to do something about this. Oh, and then you get motivated again. But there is the selfish motivation that comes from recognizing that the only truly satisfactory mental states that you have ever enjoyed have been those periods when the sense of self has been at its minimum and there has been no craving. And so that becomes, that crystallizes in your mind as the enemy, as the times that you allow that attachment to self to begin to come back a little bit, even though you know better. And you've seen the truth. You can never not know better. But you can get kind of absent-minded and forget what you know and let the attachment to self start to come up. And craving's still there. And you can, and you're going to experience it. So what happens is you start to recognize that, oh, the enemy is attachment to self, and the enemy is craving. But what I want to tell you, the answer to that, of course, is mindfulness. The answer to that is right thought, right action, right speech, right livelihood. But there's that part of right thought, right speech, right action, and right livelihood that always gets neglected. The part you always hear about is you don't do this and you don't do that. The other part is all the things that you do. And if all the things that you don't know can be summed up as, or things you don't do, you know, don't engage in false speech, don't engage in this and that and so on and forth, so on and so forth. If all of those can be summed up in terms of harmlessness, then the other half of right action can all be summed up in terms of compassion, generosity, loving kindness, patience, right? So the practice, you have to practice compassion. You have to, as you are working towards the wisdom, you have to practice compassion. And you are not practicing compassion when you have created a tiny little niche for yourself that's very comfortable and where you practice the Dharma, or where you sit in a monastery, or where you sit in a cave, or where you sit on a mountaintop. There ain't no compassion in that. I'm sorry. There isn't. There's no compassion in comfortable life devoted to Dharma practice. Even though you may tell yourself, I'm going to become enlightened so that I can enlighten other people. Even though you may run a little meditation Dharma group on the side, you have not tried to embrace the world. You have not tried to move to that place where you can dwell in nirvana while fully embracing samsara. Because what is samsara? Samsara is the suffering that's in the world. And it's not somebody else's suffering. Like I say, until everyone's awakened, it's your suffering. If there's any suffering in the world, it's your suffering. And I'm starting to learn this, and I'm starting to understand how that works. If the predictions in this book, and if the predictions by the World Business Academy are true, can you imagine the extent of suffering that is going to come? And can you appreciate the fact that you could be doing something right now to help in the process of adapting to? I mean, forget stopping it. It's not going to stop. Some people say the world's carrying capacity for our species is 50% of what it is now. but much better sources of information. Trained biologists who specialize in understanding the way the biosphere works and the way ecosystems work disagree. They put that maximum figure at 20%, 30% at most of the current world population. What's going to happen to the rest? And who are the ones that are going to go? And how are they going to go? And what is the suffering like that? So if some distant point in the future, thousands of years in the future, hundreds of years in the future, I don't know, where things have stabilized and the population of human beings is at a sustainable level. Because the thing is, that what the Earth is doing what it always does when a species gets out of control. It reacts. It doesn't react, you know, it doesn't cogitate and say, well, this is a problem species. All the little pieces that make up the world act in the only ways that they can act, and they produce an effect that returns the system to equilibrium. So if we look at some point in the future where our species is in equilibrium with the planet again, now we have to think about what happens between here and there, and what do we do? Do we say, oh my God, this is such a big problem, you know, nothing I can do about it? Do we say, Kali Yuga, samsara. Samsara has always been like that. Well, you know, it doesn't matter if samsara has always been like that. It actually doesn't matter if our species gets wiped out. Personally, I don't believe that's going to happen. Those things don't matter. What matters is the suffering, is the compassion that you need to develop in order to achieve your own awakening, and the suffering that is staring you in the face that you can do something about. Now, last night, we watched a documentary recommended by Matthew. It was absolutely fabulous. And I would recommend that absolutely everyone in this room and everyone who hears this Dharma talk watch this documentary, Salt of the Earth. It's the life story of a photographer. And he does a lot of different, fabulous photographer, does a lot of different photography in different places. But a lot of his photography is showing us that the disaster is already here. Think about what is going on in Africa. Think about what's going on in the Middle East. Think about tinder piles or something like that, all over the world, the tensions that are there. You know, many, many years ago, they did an experiment with rats. Rats like to cuddle up with each other and sleep in piles. And, you know, rats are cute. I worked with a lot of rats when I was doing science. And one of the reasons I quit science is I didn't like killing rats. But rats in their own company, I mean, they're not good in the roof of your house or anything like that, but in their own company, they are friendly, cuddly, they groom each other, they sleep together in piles, all this sort of stuff. And many years ago, somebody said, what if we keep adding more and more rats to the same cage? And at a certain point, the rats start killing and eating each other. Everybody heard about that? Been around for a long time. That's where we're already at. We're rats in a cage. There's too many rats in the cage, and we're already killing each other. Don't know how many of us are getting eaten, but if you consider our property, the resources that we would make use of if we're not killed, I mean, that's the same thing, right? We're already rats in an overcrowded cage, and we're already behaving like rats in an overcrowded cage. And all the news is about North Korea wants to start a nuclear war, and Iran wants to prepare itself to be a nuclear power, and the Arab world wants to destroy Israel, and Israel wants to keep the Arab world in a state of eternal suppression so that they can't come and destroy them. I mean, understandable. That's what aversion is all about. Israel has aversion to being destroyed. it's already happening in the world. Now, the way this documentary ends is very interesting. After this person has, he photographed all kinds of wonderful, lovely, beautiful things about this planet. But ended up doing a lot of photography about the horrible things that are happening on this planet. And does anybody in the room have any idea how many million people right now have been permanently displaced from their homes, who are living in tents, and their children are dying of disease by thousands, literally. And they're starving gradually in spite of the attempts at help. Anybody have an idea of how many millions that is?
7 million.
No, it's got to be more than that.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's more than that. Yeah, it's way more. There are, I think there's something like 4 million in the Middle East as a result of what ISIS is doing. And there's many, many more millions in different parts of Africa that the same thing is true of, I mean, it's already happening. It's already upon us. Who is it that's going to go? It's going to be those who are already suffering the most, those who are already living in poverty. But it's not going to stop with them. The point that David Loy is trying to make here, the point that all the Buddhist teachers are trying to make in here, the point that the leaders of that part of the Dharma Teachers Conference is, Buddhists, more than anyone else in the world, have the responsibility to embrace this problem as their problem, as an act of compassion. If we're committed to the belief that about compassion, then drifting through life is not the way to be a Buddhist. Finding a comfortable place where you can kind of do your thing and teach a little Dharma here and there, you're not walking the walk. You have to find something to do. If you're going to teach the Dharma, then you become a great Dharma teacher that reaches lots of people and changes lots of mind, with the idea that they don't have to become awakened. They don't have to all become stream entrants. They just have to realize that, and that's explained very well in here. Read this book. Yeah, but you should know it already. How did we get where we are? We have a culture that developed that claimed that no human being does anything except out of selfish motivations, ever. And that the only reason we act is out of desire and aversion. And the only reason that anybody ever does anything good is out of enlightened self-interest. And that is just plain false. And so if you're going to do something, if you're going to practice and teach the Dharma, don't do it in some isolated little comfortable corner. Make yourself into the kind of person who can make a difference, can reach people, and don't settle for anything less from yourself. If you find yourself drifting along trying to figure out where you fit, stop, because that can go on forever. Pick a place and go for it 100%. When you've done that, if it doesn't fit, well, then that's time maybe to look around and see where's another place that would be a better fit. But You know, this is something I used to tell myself. I used to, my manic depression runs in my family, and I used to be subject to depressions, severe depressions. And when I was in a severe depression, I had a mantra, and the mantra, it got me through it. It was, whatever you do, don't do nothing. And I would recommend that to everyone. Whatever you do, don't do nothing. Pick it, embrace it fully, do your best, and if it doesn't fit, move on. But whatever you do, don't do nothing. Do as much as you can. And what everyone has to offer is different. And you have to discover that for yourself. So I've made myself into a Dharma teacher. I don't expect everybody to make themselves into Dharma teachers. I'm trying to pick some people who have that potential so that I can multiply myself and be in many different places at the same time. And that's I think, a really valuable use of my time. I've looked at my abilities, and I feel like that's a really important thing that I can do, and I should do the best I can at it. But I think there's other things that I can do. And I'm trying to learn what those other things are. We need not just to do things, though. We need to remember. It's like the precepts. It's not just things that you do. What's really important is why you do them. You do them fully mindful and fully conscious that the reason that I'm doing this is to cultivate in myself true compassion, not make-believe compassion. True compassion. I'm doing this because the more a lot of Buddhism is fake it till you make it, right? The more you act as though you had true understanding of the interpenetrating nature of all sentient beings. Actually, it goes beyond that, the interpenetrating nature of all, period. The more understanding of that you have, the more true compassion you have. The more you practice compassion, the more that understanding will deepen. Because every act of compassion is an intentional denial of selfishness. It's an intentional placing the well-being of someone else on the same level as your own well-being. I'm not asking you to give yourself away, sacrifice yourself to the hungry lioness to be eaten. That's not my kind of philosophy. You treat yourself as you would any other person, the way a mother treats a child. Okay. Yes.
I have a lot of questions, but yeah. I'll try and keep it. And I'm sure others do too. So just can compassion, you talked about compassion and wisdom, and they go together and they're essential. True compassion, you said, and true wisdom. And you can't have one without the other. You can't have an awakening without the other. But can a life of compassion be enough for awakening? Because we don't sometimes have enough time for the wisdom to develop through study on the cushion in the monasteries, for example. And I'm going to give you a quick example. I was in a monastery in a study program, and a young French woman had spent a month in Nepal helping kids who were starving, you know, working in an orphanage. And she came and she sat in this big group of Westerners, and the teacher was talking about compassion, and she got very upset, and you know, tears were flowing, and it was a very powerful teaching. But then she said, how can you all sit here and talk about compassion when there are children out there dying? What would be your response to her?
Well, my response to her would be, it depends on what happens as a result of this discussion. If the result of this discussion is that the people in the room go out there and start doing something, then this discussion is extremely important. If all they do is talk about it and feel good about having talked about it and then go home and just continue on the same way they did before, then it's a total waste of time.
I'm so glad you're talking about this. Thank you so much.
So what?
I'm so glad you're talking about this. Thank you so much. I agonize because I know everything's falling apart and I don't feel like I'm really doing anything. Sorry. You know, I mean, it's like, it's why I'm here. But part of me, and I think this really holds me back, part of me goes, why are you sitting here? You know, like, it's always a voice in my head, like, why are you sitting here? Like, that's going to change something. But I can't see, you know, like, knowing what, within the limits of what I know about myself and in my life and my world, like, I just am stuck. Like, I don't see where to go to do something that's really effective. So I just feel stuck. And I just want, I know, I mean, it's maybe not a question you can answer. Maybe it's just like the do something thing. But, so, but I mean, I think that part of what you're saying, and I believe this, is that like, well, it has to be one part of your development, you know, mm-hmm. you have to be doing something, and then that will propel the wisdom aspect, and they'll, you know, they'll yes. work together or whatever. I just, do you have any suggestions about, like, how to, I feel like I consider things I can do, and I always just am like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, mm-hmm. I'll go join the climate march. But, I mean, and it was great, you know, mm-hmm. and it was great to organize and do that and everything, but part of me is like, what? Really? What are you really, really, really gonna, you know, like, part of me knows, like, okay, you have to really do something.
Okay.
And it's just like, do you have any suggestions for,
yes.
like...
Yes, I do. Let me just sort of address this. There's many, many different levels that you can look at this. Now, it's very important that in your home life you try to do things in a way that minimizes the impact on the environment. The common things that people do, like recycling, using more fuel-efficient vehicles, using public transportation where it's available. There's a lot of different things that you can do. But you look at them and you say, okay, I'm just one person doing this and none of my neighbors are. And what difference does it make? The thing is, you can't afford to look at it that way. You do what you can. You attend a march. I attended marches in the 60s, and I wasn't at Selma, but I would have been if I could. I got beaten up. Marching made a difference. There's go ahead, you do that march. That's a really important thing to do. But the scale of the problem is such that we have to do as much as we can. So we start at home, and then we go to marches, and then we find some other activity we engage in, and we work our way, we try to work our way to the level where, to find the level at which we can contribute most effectively and regard it as part of our practice. Now, no one who is caught in the idea that everything is falling apart around me is going to be as effective as somebody who has absolutely no attachment to what the impact of any particular thing they do or what everybody does. There's nothing more empowering than to have total compassion for the suffering, both current and future, that you can see, but not be attached to an outcome. So your practice is important for that, because wisdom is what gives you that non-attachment. Your practice is extremely important. Your practice is important in another way. The more realization you gain, the more realization the universe gains. And so it's true that even if you were just sitting in a little cave, becoming a higher and higher level bodhisattva, you are doing something. But is that the most you can do? You know, is recycling and using public transportation the most you can do? You have to, every person has to look at themselves, and no one should judge anybody else. You should ask yourself, am I truly embracing this world? And let me say something about that. That means embracing the good and the bad and everything. It's embracing the wonder of what is. That a species evolved on this planet that's capable of changing its climate. If that was a PBS special about some other planet, it would be, wow, that's incredible. That you know, inanimate matter could evolve to the point where it did that. Ooh, cool. And it is. It is really cool. The only thing uncool about it is the suffering that has already resulted and that's going to result. All the animals of so many different species is going to die. That's the only problem, is the suffering. Otherwise, it's all absolutely wonderful. Everything about it is wonderful. It's amazing. It's incredible. So that's how samsara becomes nirvana. You embrace it totally. You love every part of it. And in your love for it comes the compassion, and you do whatever you can to minimize the suffering in the world. And that will, you will achieve wisdom more quickly as a result of doing so. And the more wisdom you acquire, the more compassion you will develop. So Marianne would like to say something.
I really like what you said, and I agree with that. And I can relate to what, I don't even know your name right now, just said.
Grace.
So at least I can say that I feel better for myself and see that as a teeny tiny step towards the main goal when I keep learning about compassion and do it for myself to get started with.
Yeah.
That is one thing. And then I go home and there is that 1 mile dirt road that is really messed up by some kind of a church neighbor, and they don't dare to think about to do anything to help to maintain the road. And each bump I get into, I have that revenge, I have that hate, and then I said, hey, great, here I go. I come from the stronghold. I have all those nice ideas. And with each and every bump I go through, and I couldn't even get here if it had rained. Mm-hmm. How do I deal with that? That is even worse, at least to me.
That's the only way you can deal with that is to be mindful, to see that that is not benefiting you, that it is possible for you to change the thoughts that you have, that you know, just as in meditation, you focus on the meditation object rather than certain thoughts. So you practice when you're not thinking those thoughts. And if you succeed in practicing they arise, let them be in your peripheral awareness, but refuse to focus your attention on them. If you do that enough, then the feelings that give rise to those thoughts will start going away. And that's the thing, you know, we practice this, we have to learn, I have to learn, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm there, I'm not. In terms of the compassion part of it, that's, you know, I don't have perfect compassion yet. And I'm working on it. And you have to work on it. We have to work on it. And we work on it in exactly the same way we work on everything else. There is no difference between compassion and no self, or understanding the emptiness of self. Compassion is just another word for realizing no self. There's no difference between compassion and dependent arising. Compassion is just another way of describing the realization of dependent arising. There's no difference between compassion and impermanence. Compassion is another way of seeing and understanding impermanence. They're all the same thing. Emptiness. Compassion is the same thing as emptiness. Compassion is how we act effectively because we understand emptiness. So emptiness and compassion are the same thing. Through understanding emptiness, we're able to act more fully through compassion. All of that much has come clear to me. Now I got to work on my own conditioning and my own enhancing my own wisdom to the point where I have more of both of those, and I'm never going to have enough of both of those until all sentient beings have that wisdom and compassion. So this is part of the work I'm doing on myself by going on at you about developing compassion.
Yeah, but when I go home, for instance, there's more than 20 potholes where you can get stuck or even can't get through. Do I stop in the first pothole and sit there until I have compassion?
You don't have to stop there, no. But you have to be mindful that I have the thoughts and the emotions that are arising, and you have to be mindful that you would much rather approach this situation with wisdom, acceptance, non-attachment, non-aversion, and compassion. That's what you have to practice doing. You don't have to stop. If it helps to stop for a few seconds just to run that through your mind, then go ahead. But you don't have to stop and wait for compassion. You just have to wait long enough that you're mindful that, yes, this is one of those zillions of little obstacles in my life to achieving the absolute true happiness, the loving kindness, the freedom from ill will, and the freedom from suffering, which is your goal. It's one little piece of it. It's an opportunity. And if next week there's 21 potholes, do you try to remind yourself that it's just one, you now have another opportunity to do this.
Yeah, and then I get that far when I'm kind of a loser by the time I get home. Then I try to retain all that what I have learned and get back at least to a comfortable point. And then I read the newspaper with the Apache stronghold, for instance. So that messes it up again. And there is more obstacles, it seems to me, than I have time to really learn what it is about.
You start with where you are. You practice. And you do sitting practice and walking practice so that you will have mindfulness. Then you bring that mindfulness into the world. You start with where you are. Don't be disappointed with yourself because you're not someplace else yet. Don't blame yourself. Don't feel like you should be different than what you are. But work with where you are. We start where we are, and we advance from where we are one step at a time. A journey of 1,000 miles, if you think of it as 1,000 miles, seems impossible. But if you take it step by step, you'll get there. And it's the same way with this. You start with where you are, and you be honest with yourself about where you are. You say, well, there I am, anger and aversion arising. And I would like there not to be anger and aversion, but there is, and I accept that there is. But you make the resolve that you're going to try for the day when there is no anger and aversion in this situation, and you know how to do it. You know the way to get to that place, but you can't magically be there. You just take it a step at a time. Take it a pothole at a time.
Something Grace said, really struck a chord with me. I know that a lot of people don't know how they can adapt, how they can have that. You know, they see the suffering of others, and they want to, you know, they want to adapt to, and they want to help, and they want to do all these things, and they have got no idea where to start. When people do have an idea of what to do, but they feel powerless to enact that, that's a place that I've always sort of felt like I've been, is that, oh yeah, I could tell you a thousand things of what to do. I just don't know how to tell you that, and I don't know how to get that message out there.
It's like the 1,000-mile journey. It's like looking at the mountain and say, I can never move this mountain. You don't do that. You pick up a shovel and you move the first shovelful. You know that you're surrounded by people that are suffering in all kinds of different ways. And you look for the opportunities. I mean, what I think of, you know, every time I check out at Safeway or Costco, you know, I don't check out of too many places, but every time I do, I try to be polite and friendly. You know, they have to pretend to be polite and friendly, but sometimes you can tell they're having a rough day. It doesn't matter. You don't assume that just because they look like they're happy and having a good time that they are. You know, be nice to them. Wish them, you know, they say have a nice day because a manager told them that this is your job, and if you don't, this is store policy, and if you don't say that, you get caught at it, you know, you're going to get fired. So they always say have a nice day. Well, I always say have a nice, I say you have a really great day too, and I mean it, and I try to say it like I mean it. It's as simple as that, and from there it builds up to, who knows, you may find yourself. You cannot predict, but you may find yourself in a situation 10 years from now where you can do something that's going to affect a million people. Not only that, there's all kinds of little things you do between now and then that you don't know how they ramify. You did this little thing, and it multiplied to 10 people, and then spread from there to 1,000, and so on and so forth. Good or bad, you don't know where things end up. So you never be discouraged. You never look at it and say, oh my God, I can never move that mountain. You start shoveling. Okay. So I got into preaching mode.
Thank you.
Gave a sermon. I thought it was a pretty good one myself. And it's all about what's been on my mind since the teacher, Dharma teacher conference, reading this book, seeing that documentary last night. And I recommend both the book, just a Buddhist response to the climate emergency, has many different contributors, but David Lloyd's an easy one to remember that some of you are probably already familiar with. The documentary is called Salt of the Earth, and the photographer's name is Delgado. Salgado, that's right. I don't know where I got Delgado. Salgado, right. And see it, you know, and think about what I said, and remember, if you're headed for wisdom and compassion, then studying the Dharma and having insights does a lot for the wisdom part. But you got to do something about the compassion part too. And they work together. So I think I said that clearly enough. And it was fun. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to do only one sit, and then we're going to break for lunch. Okay? Because I went on so long. Thank you very much.